mandando um batalhão. O macaco vem chegar.
For these children in the favelas, the slums in Sao Paulo in Brazil, life could be very different from that of their poverty-stricken parents when they grow up. If the experts are right, that is. I'm Peter Day, and I'm looking at BRICS, the proposition that Brazil, Russia, India and China will be wealthy global powers by the year 2050, and so will their people. As the children sit down to a birthday party, I'm off in search of their future and ours. Across town at the China-Brazil Business and Cultural Institute, young Brazilian lawyers and executives are preparing for a future in which their country's fortunes may be even more tightly tied to China's than they are already. The institute's director is Alexandre Xi.
I teach the history of China, the philosophy of China, especially Taoism, Buddhism and Confucianism.
You don't teach Chinese communism.
Pardon?
Do you teach communism or Chinese communism or market socialism to your customers,
no.
Your Brazilians?
No. We only teach language and also Chinese customer and philosophy.
China is going to be enormously important in the world. It's going to be much bigger in the world than it is at the moment. Chinese companies, Chinese products, Chinese people. In 50 years' time, they're going to be everywhere in the world, aren't they?
I think so. Chinese really are going to reach any country, any place. No?
What do you think we in America and in Europe ought to make of the rise of these new, huge economic stars in the world? Ought we to be frightened of it?
I think so.
I got a European perspective on the great rise of China from Eugen von Keller, head of the Beijing office of the German management consultancy Roland Berger. With a weather eye on some significant official visits abroad made this year by the Chinese President Hu Jintao, Eugen von Keller seems to think the West should be more alarmed than it is.
If you look today into Southeast Asia, you do not see only the Chinese tourists flooding the places. You see as well Chinese investment, not only in the tourist industry buying up hotels and so forth. They buy up as well companies. And it's not only there, it's as well in South America. And I wonder whether the Americans have understood what is happening there. You just have to follow the travel itinerary of Hu Jintao. He was in Chile, he was in Argentina, he was in Brazil. That had a very clear strategy behind it.
Raw materials.
Yes.
We'll invest money in you, we can pay off your debts, was the kind of thing he was talking about in Argentina. You supply us with soybeans or in Brazil with iron ore. And I've seen it coming into China, and it's awesome, the sight of it coming into the ports.
In the 19th century, we had the great game. This is the new great game, and far more stakes are at risk in this game.
But what essentially we're seeing, if you stand back from being in the middle of it, as you are for a moment, is the emergence of a new manufacturing powerhouse for the world.
Of course, that had already happened 10 years, 15 years ago in the clothing sector. At the end, it will be 70% of all exported clothing will come from China. The next step was that China went into the electronic mass product markets. Consumer electronics will, at the end, be in China. There will be other industries which will migrate into China. So, for example, the automotive industry has already started, as well the automotive component industry. So you see there are other industries following up.
So who's going to make what in the West then? Who's going to make what in Europe and the United States?
One should not be too much worried about these mass consumer goods industries moving into China. The issue which worries me personally more is that a lot of research and development is as well moving into China. A lot of services are as well moving into China and into India specifically. So what will happen if China will set the standards at one day for mobile phones. Companies like Siemens, for example, they are already not only manufacturing all their standard phones in China, they have as well put all research and development into China, because the standards will be set there and the consumers will decide on what applications they want to have. The Chinese consumers, not the Germans anymore. So what will be left, your question, what will be left to us? Indeed.
Maybe Germany and France shouldn't produce any cars in the future. Maybe they should all be produced in China and India, and they should move on to different businesses. But you talk to political leaders about such issues today in those countries, they think you're nuts.
This from the man who first publicised the whole BRICS concept, the Goldman Sachs economist Jim O'Neill.
I think Europe's political leaders today are worried about the emergence of the BRICS, and it goads them into a response of trying to block any of these things from influencing policy or developments in their countries. And all that will do is make those economies more efficient and, if anything, accelerate the decline.
Then what, I asked Jim O'Neill, should politicians in Europe do to protect their jobs and their industries from the rise of the BRICS?
There's nothing they can do to stop the growth of these countries. What they need to do is open the mines up and open the borders up and share in it and move on to other industries. That's what they're going to have to do whether they like it or not. Or otherwise, the Europe of the future will become a tourist destination for wealthy Chinese and Indians and others, and it won't have anything else going for it other than being some great historic place to visit for a vacation.
Ride the New York City subway to 7th Avenue, the Garment District. These days, very few of the clothes being loaded onto the racks here carry Made in America labels. Americans long ago watched their textile mills shut down, and then most of their clothes factories as well.
Stand clear of the closing doors, please.
But what role for a rich country such as America in the garment industry of the future?
Increasingly, we are training our students to become citizens of a global industry.
Eric Hertz is Director of Executive Education at the Fashion Institute of Technology, FIT, in New York.
FIT is hot.
FIT is intense.
And FIT is trying to prepare its students for the realities of an ever more globalized, ever less Americanized world.
It's not just fashion.
The industry will survive and will grow, but will grow on an international basis. More and more of the jobs will be available overseas. We expect that many companies will continue to be based here because this is a creative hub. A lot of the design energy emanates from a place like New York, but absolutely the manufacturing, production, all the other functions are likely to be happening overseas.
Eric Hertz of the Fashion Institute of Technology in New York. He says Americans who want to work in the fashion industry of the future may have to work overseas. This is more than just the garment business. The global trend of outsourcing is exporting more and more jobs out of the rich and expensive countries and into poor and cheap ones.
At Infosys, we focus on making your organization more responsive in a dynamic environment.
One of the famous global pioneers of this process is the Indian information technology giant Infosys, working for hundreds of huge overseas companies doing jobs that used to be done in-house. Last year, Infosys in Bangalore in southern India received 1 million job applications. And Chris Gopalakrishnan, co-founder and chief operating officer, told me that not all of them came from Indians.
Previously, people used to migrate from developing countries to developed countries in search of work. We are seeing some reversal of that. We are seeing now college graduates around the world applying for jobs, moving to locations like Bangalore. And so, you know, I think a lot of interesting opportunities and interesting times are ahead.
So people are coming to India in the same way that they used to go to America, are they?
Last year, we had about 70 interns come from places like MIT, you know, Harvard, Wharton, London School of Business, INSEAD, etc. This year, we have expanded that to 100 students. 8,000 students applied for these 100 positions. It's one of the most sought-after internship program in these major campuses.
Sought-after jobs in places a long way from the conventional career beat for privileged Western graduates. And educated young people in all these countries, Brazil, Russia, India and China, have caught this wave of hope. They trill with expectation. I must say it's about time. For the 58 years since independence, it's been deliberate Indian government policy to build an education system to produce these world-class scientists, doctors, and engineers. So I've come to Summerfield School in a middle-class neighborhood in the Indian capital, Delhi, to meet three teenagers with no doubts about their global future.
I'm Rinalini Malik, and I wanted to be in media. I'm Shivangi, and I want to be an engineer in the future.
My name is Apoorv Saini, and I want to be a scientist.
Here is this theory that India is going to be very important in the world.
Yeah, India is it is becoming important to the world. So we have to take decision very firmly. We have to work hard. And nothing else.
Now it's chance for India. They have to do it. They are going to do it and they have to do it.
You're very optimistic.
Yeah, I am. Always optimistic. Yeah.
And I can easily assure that after 50 years, India will definitely be ahead at the top and among the world power, one of the richest world power.
And how will the rest of the world change as a result of India being ahead like this?
Jealous. I would say the rest of the world will be jealous.
But there are billions of people like you with your sort of ambitions. Certainly millions, probably billions of people with the same sort of ambition and clarity of purpose.
Yeah, there are. See, at this age, we have to have some aim and goal in our eyes. So you have to aim high.
What are you going to do in the world when you're qualified? How are you going to change it?
When I'm qualified, I just want to live in India, get a reputed position, but still in India itself only. India is giving education and you're leaving outside to give your service to other countries. That's not right, actually. So it's better if you study here, you become qualified, and then you just have a job out here.
But is this thing globalization, is globalization good or bad? Well, the answer will have to wait. These students had to get on with the serious business of getting educated. And as we heard, after decades in which it seemed the torrents of clever people were India's biggest export, at least some of these teenagers feel they don't need to leave home to build their fortunes. Neither does this young singer. She's Roberta Sá, 24 years old, a rising star in Brazilian music, and she hopes the world. But the world can listen on her terms. She feels no need to sing in anything but her native language.
People is very hopeful here. This word is right, yeah. Hopeful.
Enormous hope, yeah.
Yeah, and I think people of Brazil is waking up for their potential, you know.
And you could sing in English because your English is good enough for that, but you want to sing in Portuguese.
Yeah, I want to sing in Portuguese. I think if you decide to sing only in Portuguese and only different rhythms in Portuguese, you can, because it's so rich. And I think few countries have that.
Roberta Sá. Brazil, Russia, India, China, boarding the express train to a dominant future. You're listening to BRICS, the changing face of global power, on the BBC World Service. I'm Peter Day. Judging from what we've heard so far, the coming decades are going to be pretty uncomfortable for the current global giants. But I can't help noticing there's something missing from all these visions of the future, the entire continent of Africa. Kwesi Botchwe is the former finance minister of Ghana, now a driving force in African development initiatives. Why does he think Africa remains a blank space on so many expert maps of the world in 2050?
Even as we talk about the BRICS and so on, I think it's important to understand that you make assumptions about what the world will be like in the next 50 years, and you marginalize Africa only because you assume that nothing is going to change. That is no way to see any region in its true dynamism. I am certain that if we address the constraints on African development today and address them consistently and vigorously, you will see a transformation of the region and the emergence of success stories that are sustained over perhaps a generation.
Africans can't accept the idea of being left behind as the world redefines itself. And Kwesi Botchwe makes the important point that all of these future projections about the BRICS are extrapolations of how things seem to the experts here and now. Reality over the next 50 years might turn out to be different. What's absolutely certain is that great big change is happening. One man who has to steer his huge international advertising and marketing group through stormy global waters is Sir Martin Sorrell, chief executive of WPP. It's a business based in London, but with many of the world's biggest corporations as its clients.
What the growth of the BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India and China, tells you is that anybody running a major global business has to think of it almost like a portfolio of investments, placing your bets in those parts of the world where growth is faster and stimulated.
If India and China are on the rise, and other countries as well, they're not just on the rise a bit, they're on the rise in the most enormous way, huge engines of growth in China and India.
Right.
And they, at some stage, looking out towards 2050, are going to want and demand a place at the top table, which may mean America moving over or Europe moving over in a very significant way. And that's going to be difficult for American industry mentally, isn't it?
Well, I think it already is. I mean, with the sale of IBM's PC division to Lenovo, with higher domestic appliances expanding, they sponsor the Worcestershire County cricket team, would you believe? Who would have thought the RCA brand would be controlled by a Chinese company?
But those are just raindrops on the windscreen compared with what's going to happen in the future.
Absolutely, absolutely. And if you look back in history, when a country or when a region has seemed to have complete hegemony, political, economic, social, cultural hegemony, and there's been no other countervailing force, somebody or something or some country or some region steps in to fill the vacuum. And I think that country or that region is China and it's Asia. And clearly, we're already seeing a significant shift in wealth to the East, and it's very difficult for us in the West to get our minds around that.
Marx said that capitalism would make the rope to hang itself with, and the investment in China, you see, pressing down on profit margins in Western countries because of the rise of Chinese and Indian manufacturing, means that the West, the established leaders of industry all over the place, have got to rethink how they make their money, haven't they? I mean, it's as basic as that.
The trouble with the Chinese is that they listen. The trouble with the Chinese is that they learn and they adapt very, very quickly. And the way they adapt and the way they change is phenomenal.
Yes, China is impatient and hungry. For Russian oil, for Indian know-how.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to São Paulo. Please remain.
And for Brazilian iron ore and Brazilian soybeans. China's farmland and its water is limited. A wealthier China needs more and more imported food. Carlo Lovatelli is president of the Brazilian Agro-Business Association.
There is a big need for food, and Brazil has the capacity and the potentiality to provide a good deal of that. So undoubtedly, we see Brazil as being a food seller for the future, for the world.
Will that give Brazil political power in the world that it doesn't have at the moment? Is that happening?
I hope so.
Forklift trucks trundling from warehouse to loading bay in the big Brazilian port of Santos make visible right in front of any visitor the new trade routes that will define the 21st century. The Chinese want to build new railways to get food to the ports of Brazil more easily and then more quickly to Chinese mouths. But perhaps this excitement has happened before. Brazilians always remember the wisecrack that Brazil's brilliant future is always in the future, and it's been like that for 100 years. However, the Minister of Development, Industry and Foreign Trade, Luiz Fernando Falan, insists that this time it's different, and because of that difference, the world as a whole is going to be a different place.
I believe that during the next decade will be the country of the present. The present, not the country of the future.
Is this going to be a benign growth, the world getting richer and Brazil and Latin America and other parts of the world sharing in this as a all boats rising sort of phenomenon? Or are they going to be terrible trade frictions? As the established, the post-Second World War landscape is disturbed quite a lot, are we going to see frictions as well as economic prosperity?
Well, that is normal. When you increase trade and business and relationship, it's like marriage. When you date, you don't have frictions, but when you get married, some frictions appear. and the ability to manage the frictions and to get the benefits of the relationship, that is the challenge. And I would say that to increase trade and prosperity all over the world is the only way to get a peaceful scenario.
The map of the world is changing to reflect this shift of trade and geopolitics, and there are many more shifts to come as emerging nations vie with older powers such as the United States and Europe for food and energy and raw materials. Clyde Prestowitz, a former trade official under President Reagan 20 years ago, when Japan was the up-and-coming problem for the West, wonders aloud if Americans are in for an even more serious shock to their national psyche and national fortunes.
I think within, 20 years, the dollar will not be the world's money, maybe in less time. I think we're going to see oil being priced in a basket of currencies, yen, euros, pounds maybe, dollars.
Talk about the pure psychology of that for a moment. The dollar, the moving aside of America to let other people come in, not as a political problem, but as a psychological problem for America. It is, isn't it?
Well, it's a challenge. It's really a challenge, yeah. I mean, the thing is, when you speak to an American audience and you talk about the dollar could fall, it doesn't register. The reaction of an American audience is, okay, dollar's up, dollar's down, so what? I live in the U.S., so why do I care? They don't understand the privilege that the U.S. has, that when Americans buy oil, they just print green paper with presidential pictures on it. They don't understand that when Brazilians or Japanese buy oil, they've got to sell Lexuses or coffee or something and earn the dollars and then go buy the oil. So when you explain this to an American audience, it comes as a bit of a shock. You know, and then when you suggest, well, you know, there could come a time when oil could be priced in euros, and we'd have to sell the Europeans something and get euros to buy the oil, you know, this is a big adjustment. So it's very important how that adjustment is handled, that it's handled maturely and properly.
Clyde Prestowitz, a former Reagan administration trade official, author of the recent book 3 billion New Capitalists. A banner fluttering by the side of the road here in Mumbai rather overstates the pride that Indians feel in their new global role. It says, India conquers the US without firing a shot. I don't know about conquer, but there'll certainly be serious competition from the BRICS with similar force to the way the rising Japan challenged and shocked America and Europe in the 1980s. And the competition is going to be relentless, even for the BRICS themselves, as poorer countries further down the economic food chain learn from them how to claim a piece of the global marketplace and do it for a bargain price. Unless, that is, something goes wrong, as it often does with predictions of this magnitude. So next week, let's hear about the doubts and contradictions surrounding these powerful BRICS predictions, and what they might mean for all of us, wherever we happen to be.